So, yes, I'm Padma Vajra, and I'm delighted to be here this morning to speak to you about Sangharakshita Bhante, Sangharakshita, Erkin Sangharakshita, the founder of the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, because you're having a series, aren't you, on Sangharakshita in honour of his 90th birthday, which is in August. I'd just also like to say that this centre is very important to me. I haven't been here for quite a long time, but I lived in Croydon between 1980 and 1986. It was quite a long period and a very formative period for me, and I led a lot of classes in this very room, a lot of beginners classes, beginners courses, gave lots of talks, led lots of festivals, led lots of pujas. And it's quite interesting, this morning leading the meditation, I was reminded of the I used to lead a double meditation on and puja on Sunday mornings, and just noticing the sort of dappled light coming through, it was very reminiscent of that time. So I'm very glad that the centre is thriving, and there's so many people here and such good energy. It's great to see. But really, enough of me. I need to talk about Sangharakshita, and I'm really glad to be talking about him because he is my teacher. I first met Sangharakshita when I was 17 in Brighton, a long time ago now. And I was ordained by him a couple of years later. I was named by him. He is my my teacher, my spiritual friend, my spiritual guide, and I am his disciple. And I have a deep love and reverence for him. He isn't simply the founder of our movement. That's very important and all that sort of thing. But for me, it's a very strong personal relationship and connection. I was thinking, coming down, of a really wonderful bit of writing I'd read by a West African Sufi, writing about his teacher, his Sufi peer, his Sufi sheikh. And this West African Sufi said that the disciple cannot not love his master. The disciple has to love his master because he is his master. And I thought that was, and he went on to say, I regard my teacher as a perfect man. This is a sort of technical Sufi term of a very high state. He said, although I regard him as a perfect man, I don't know that he's a perfect man. And he would not accept the designation perfect man. But for me, he is a perfect man because I have never met anybody greater, anybody higher. And I thought that expressed very well my own feeling about Sangharakshita. I'm not sure I'd use the phrase perfect man, but I've never met anybody greater. I've never met anybody deeper. He is my teacher. I love my teacher. And I also have no idea of his attainment. I haven't a clue. I actually don't even think about that. I don't know where he is on the path. It really doesn't interest me. What I know is he's had a profound and transformative effect on my own life. And he occupies the sort of centre of my consciousness in many ways. I think of him every day. I send metta to him every day. I meditate, and the meditations I do are related to him every day. And I still do the practice he gave me at the time I was ordained every day. So there's a very strong and deep connection. And I say this because you just need to know it. This isn't going to be a sort of objective account of Sangharakshita. This is me telling you about my teacher, telling you about my spiritual friend, I want you to all know that and be sympathetic to that, if you like. But as I say, I have no idea where he is situated on the spiritual path. And as I say, it really doesn't interest me. I know that he is somebody who I, how can I say, I always, whenever I go to see him, I always have a sense of great depth, and I couldn't claim to know Sangharakshita. Even friends of mine who've been very close to Sangharakshita spent a lot of time with him. It's very obvious that they don't know him really deeply. I saw him some months ago, and of course he's a very old man now and he can't really see, and you know, you don't get to spend a lot of time with him. And you know, we were talking about various things, but again I just had this sense of great depth, and you know, this sense of there's a lot more going on than just the sort of surface of things. In some ways a bit like going to see my granddad now, but this immense sense of depth. I remember one older member years ago saying that he thought Sangharakshita was a bit like the TARDIS, you know, Doctor Who. looks like a, you know, a police telephone box, and very ordinary. I mean, they're not so ordinary these days, are they? But they were ordinary years and years ago, decades ago. But inside, there is this sort of sense of, you just get these glimpses of something, you know, really vast and mysterious and complex. And in thinking about how can I talk about Bhante, how can I talk about Sangharakshita to you, I thought the way I'd do it would be to do it in relation to a teaching which he has... Well, the first time I heard this teaching was in a talk that he gave years ago. And I'm quite aware of this teaching, and Malcolm will be aware of it, because... We were doing a retreat, and you were there too, weren't you, Stephen, as well? We were doing a retreat on the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, which is a very wonderful, magical Mahayana Sutra, which was expounded by Sangharakshita in a series of talks. When was it, 1979? When I was in India, actually, on the first visit I had to India. So I wasn't actually here for the lectures. They were sent out on cassette tape to us. Magical exposition of this weird and wonderful trippy sutra. And in the course of that lecture series, Sangharakshita gave a talk called On Being All Things to All Men, because the character Vimalakirti in this sutra is the very embodiment of what's known as upaya kaushalya, skillful means that comes out of transcendental wisdom, very, very high attainment. Just this, the evocation of Vimalakirti is that he can talk, communicate, connect with anybody, whatever their circumstances. And there's a wonderful evocation of him in the sutra. And Sangharakshita talked about what skillful means is by talking about what are known as the Sangraha Vastus, the means of unification, the way in which a bodhisattva gathers together a community in order to do the work of creating a Buddha field, a Buddha land, bringing together a group of people to work together to create a Buddha land in this land, to purify the Buddha field, as it's technically called. And I was thinking, coming down on the train this morning, that, well, I first heard that teaching from Sangharakshita, and I was thinking about him as someone who exemplifies, to my mind, the Sangraha Vastus. So the Sangraha Vastus are, first of all, an old favourite, dana, generosity. Secondly, artacharya, which is... probably best translated as meaningful activity or living meaningfully. Thirdly, the second one is priyavadita, kindly or loving, affectionate speech. The third one is artacharya, living meaningfully. And the fourth is samanatata, which can be translated as exemplification, or it has an alternative of So empathy, treating others as you'd treat yourself. So I want to go through these and illustrate them by telling you some things about Sangharakshita, particularly sort of personal experiences of him. So first of all, there's dana or generosity, but with this, you know, you're familiar with this from the Eightfold Path and the Bodhisattva ideal and that sort of thing. But as a practice to create a spiritual community, this generosity is very particular. In Sangharakshita's account of this particular teaching, he says that a spiritual community should be characterized by the constant exchange of presents, of gifts, a continual flow of giving between those within the community, and obviously going out, reaching out to others beyond the community as well, because of course a spiritual community isn't a fixed thing anyway, and that's what a bodhisattva does. There is just this constant flow of generosity, not as a sort of tactic to, you know, to do how to win friends and influence people, not as a sort of tactic, but Sangharakshita says coming out of the bodhisattva's delighted awareness of others. It's a lovely phrase, this delighted awareness of others. The delight in their dharma potential, their spiritual potential, their potential for enlightenment. A bodhisattva is someone, that's the way they see people. We see people in all sorts of weird and wonderful ways. A bodhisattva just sees people as potential Buddhas, potential bodhisattvas. It's a lovely expression that in the Vimalakirti Nidesha, describing the bodhisattva's maitri, the bodhisattva's metta, the great love of a bodhisattva. And the bodhisattva's love in particular is the love that continuously matures and ripens and develops living beings. This is what a bodhisattva's love is. And that's expressed in generosity, in giving of themselves. Yes, there'll be all sorts of things given, material things, psychological things, spiritual things, but really they give themselves. So I want to talk about this in relation to Bhante, in relation to Sangharakshita, this business of delighted awareness. And I have to say, I've had quite vivid experiences of being on the end of Sangharakshita's delighted awareness of my potential. In many ways, Sangharakshita is he's not a sort of smiley, kind of happy clappy, kind of clubbable socialite. I mean, he really isn't like that at all. He's sort of fiercely uncharismatic and even quite sort of severe looking sometimes. Somebody once said to, I think it was Sangharakshita himself, said to my friend Arloka about a painting he'd done of Sangharakshita, and Sangharakshita said, well, you know, I'm not smiling or something like that. And Arloka said, well, we didn't say this to Sangharakshita, he said it to me. He said, yeah, well, he doesn't smile that much. Actually, he can, and he does. But yes, this sense of being on the end of somebody's delighted awareness. There was a couple of occasions when that happened. It happened in Brighton. I'd left Brighton and I was living in London. But I used to go down to Brighton after I'd left for, you know, because I was supposed to be still keeping an oversight of the bookshop that we had there. Not very well. I was, 19 at that time, and I travelled down on one occasion with Sangharakshita, and we stayed with some friends, Visantra, I think. And in the morning, I came down for breakfast after meditating, and Sangharakshita was sitting in this little kitchen. And just to give you the sort of, I've had an experience of Sangharakshita's different, sartorial periods, if you like, the different phases of his the kind of gear he wore. So this was the plum-coloured suit period. This was 1976. The plum-coloured suit, and DM shoes, sort of cherry red coloured. Before DMs were fashionable, he was well ahead. And quite, you know, his long, sort of slightly greasy hair. Anyway, I was making tea and he was sitting there and he had a sort of grin on his face. And I wasn't ordained then, I'd asked for ordination. And he looked at me and he said, by the way, I've decided to ordain you. And I was very, very excited, very, very excited. And I said, well, I don't really know what to say. And he said, well, you really don't have to say anything. And he was obviously really enjoying the fact that I was embarrassed, excited, spilling the tea a bit, the toast. Then he went into a bit of thing and he said, young people have a lot to offer our movement. Now, 19 was young in the movement. Old in those days was sort of late 20s. And they were the old people in those days. But he went into a whole thing about, he said, look, you know, you really don't have to go through the world and get sort of messed up by it. That was the implication. And I think one of the things he was doing was that, understandably, quite a few people at that time didn't take me entirely seriously. I was wet behind the ears, naive, had very little experience. But what Sangharakshita was doing, he was just delighting in the fact that I loved the Dharma and really encouraging me in my love of the Dharma and to live from that, probably knowing full well that in becoming an order member I wouldn't be leaving the world and I would no doubt go through things. So that there was that, and it was so encouraging, such an affirmation, and not just words. You know, I'd already decided that Sangharakshita was my teacher. I'd had communication with him, I'd heard his lectures and things like that, read whatever books were available. But when someone that you really respect says that to you with real pleasure, it really means something, has a very, very powerful effect. And then later, I had this very peculiar experience with him travelling back on what must have been the last slow train from Brighton to London. And We were going back through the dark, and he didn't particularly want to talk, so he handed me a book that he'd got from one of the second-hand bookshops in Brighton. It was a great second-hand bookshop browser, Sangharakshita. So I was reading this book and just dozing off on this train journey and just falling asleep. And every so often I'd wake up, and Sangharakshita was sitting opposite me, and his posture was like this. And he was looking at me with this piercing gaze and this delighted smile, and so I was sort of coming into consciousness, and there was this face looking at me, and I had this very weird feeling that he was seeing me very, very deeply and clearly, and that perhaps I was more transparent to him asleep than awake. But again, there was that sort of delighted quality, you know, to the communication. And yes, it found its fullest expression, I would say, at my ordination. I was ordained on a weekend retreat. That's the way it happened in those days. I was ordained on a weekend retreat. And one of the things about that weekend was Sangharakshita's generosity. He led the retreat, he led all the meditations and pujas, he led a seminar, a fantastic seminar on a song of Milarepa called The Shepherd's Search for Mind. You know, there's even a moment where he starts pointing out the nature of luminous mind, and you know, that thrilling moment where you feel that you're seeing it, you know, the luminous mind that is, you know, always present. I went back through the seminar and I couldn't, you know, work out, you know, what I'd actually seen. But and then of course there were the private and public ordinations. And he also got, I should say, he got dressed up for the occasion. In those days Sangharakshita would wear his yellow robes. He had long hair, was really very long. And he appeared in his robes, and he was also wearing this very high collared kind of orange gold Tibetan shirt made from some Chinese silk embossed with dragons and all sorts of patterns. And Lokamitra, who was one of my Kalyana Mitras, was admiring this shirt and his robes. And Sangharakshita, it can be very, very playful, Sangharakshita, extremely playful. You can really get a feeling for the Bodhisattva Leela sometimes being around him when he was younger, this really teasy, playful quality. He said, well, as Richard, that was my name, is into things Tibetan, I was really into things Tibetan, I thought I ought to dress up. And he had this special mala, these brown beads, and I said, and, you know, what about the mala, the beads you've got, Bantu, the rosary? He said, ah, these were beads given to me by my teacher, Mr. Chen. They're called moon and star beads, and every so often there were these white beads. And I said to him, what about the white beads? And he said, ah, they're every 29 beads for certain practices. And again, he was really, really enjoying himself. He was really sort of playing with him, as it was said. But I can't really say very much particularly about the private ordination, because it's one of those things that is very, it is just very, very personal. It's very much of the heart. But it was a very, very powerful and vivid experience for me. And I've reflected on it over the years. I thought at the time it was something to do with sort of tantric magic or something like that. I'd had a particularly powerful initiation, and that was actually true in some ways. But again, it was that sense of being taken completely seriously. Again, this sense of being with somebody with a very, very strong and delighted awareness of me, of my spiritual potential, of really witnessing what I really was, what I was really supposed to be doing. It's as if, looking back, what was going on, he was saying, or the implication was, this is real, this isn't a game. He was actually taking me more seriously than I took myself. And if the man or the person, man or the woman who you most respect and revere relates to you like that, it's extremely powerful. In fact, it was sort of unhinging after the ordination. I mean, I had some extremely kind of overwhelming experiences. It was a bit like being sort of plugged into the national grid, and I felt really fried, by the experience. So something very, very strong in the communication, which I've never forgotten, and which I, sort of meditate on every day. And then at the public ordination, again, this sense of his delighted awareness. I was ordained with an order member named Ratnaguna, who some of you might know. He's a very, very dear friend. We have a very, very strong bond. And I remember very vividly when he told us our names. He was really enjoying telling our names. Ratnaguna, the precious qualities, the jewel-like qualities. And you say, when people say Ratnaguna's name, they should have a sense of jewels descending, from the sky, multicoloured jewels. And when people say Padmavajra's name, they should see lotuses springing up and vajras descending. And it was just this tremendous enjoyment. This is not something personal to be in Ratnaguna. I mean, I'd seen him do a number of public ordinations. This delighted awareness, when you name somebody, you're giving expression to, the delight that you feel in their particular qualities, in their dharmic potential. So yes, he really has exemplified to me this generosity, this giving, in terms of, yes, this expression of delight in spiritual potential. There's so much more I could say about his generosity. I mean, I do want to come on to other things, just the generosity of him giving the Dharma. I've just done this retreat on the Vimalakirti Nidesha, and going through the lectures that Sangharakshita gave. Well, I wouldn't have a clue about how to read the Vimalakirti Nidesha without Sangharakshita's lectures. And so many places, so much Dharma has he given, so much he's explicated for us. And it's very interesting sometimes in our own order and in our own movement, people don't realise very often how much their understanding of the Dharma is actually derived from Sangharakshita. They assume that their understanding of Buddhism is independent, but it actually isn't. You know, some of the particular things that we emphasise, like spiritual friendship, that's his discovery. You know, it's come out of his own Dharma practice, and his own discovery of the transformative power of communication between spiritual friends. That's not something that you're going to necessarily get in the general Buddhist tradition. Hopefully it is there to be found, but that's very, very particular. It's very, very particular discovery of communication with anybody. How powerfully transformative that is. You know, you can see him discovering that when he comes back from India in the very, very early days of his time in England, even before he'd started the Tri Ratna. He starts to talk about communication. It's a brilliant passage in one of his very early lectures where he talks about going for refuge to the Sangha. And he said, going for refuge to the Sangha is moving from mere social contact to communication. And he said, by communication, I mean a vital mutual responsiveness, a common exploration of the spiritual world in complete honesty, in complete harmony, where the distinction between the more experienced and the less experienced loses its meaning. Extraordinary insight into the nature of Sangha and communication. Well, he hasn't got that from the Pali Canon. That's come from his experience. Come from his actual experience of living the Dharma life in friendship with others and being willing to step out of the bhikshu position and really get into communication with people. So there's so much, you know, of Sangharakshita that our Dharma practice that, you know, is based on his particular vision and insight, which we completely take for granted now, which is great. It's good that it's sort of there, but it's very important to remember where it comes from. So that's something on Sangharakshita and Dana. And of course, one of the things about this kind of quality of generosity, when somebody gives themselves in the way that I've described, it does have a sort of magnetic quality. It does sort of draw, you know, people together. You know, I think, you know, Sangharakshita has been very successful as a teacher because, you know, he's given himself in that way, and people have wanted to give themselves to each other, you know, in that way. So that's the first one. But maybe time really is running on, so I need to go on to the next one, which is Priya Vadita, loving speech. But in a way, I've already been saying about his loving speech. This phrase, Priya Vadita, the word Priya is such one of those really lovely Sanskrit words. I mean, it means loving, affectionate, kindly, very, very strong word. And yes, Vadita, speech or communication. I mean, the Buddha talks about his disciples needing to always look at each other with the eye of affection, the Priya Chakshu. And yes, their words being the expression of that. And I've talked about the way Sangharakshita can express that in terms of delight. But of course, as he says in the lecture, Priya Vadita doesn't mean going around calling everybody darling and dear and things like that. And I remember there was I have to tell this story. In the lecture, he said he was listening to a radio play, or he caught a snatch of a radio play, where somebody says in an American accent, "I'm going to kill you right now, darling." And we were very taken with that phrase when we worked in Hockney's. Right now, and right now, darling, just to say, when we were working in the restaurant, became a kind of buzzword when we wanted food quickly. So, right now, darling. And that then got abbreviated to RND. So, sorry, it's a crazy little kind of thing there. But anyway, let's come back to loving speech. And yes, I've talked about the sort of the delightful aspect of Bhaktisanghara, actually. But of course, loving speech is sometimes the speech which isn't actually pleasant to hear, but is actually really kind. You know, sometimes it can be speech that really is revealing to you your faults and your failings and the things that you really need to do, that you really need to work on. And I have actually had a few experiences of being on the end of that speech, one of them happened at Arietar and one that happened at the LBC, and they were all to do with Croydon at that time. Some of you might have heard that back in the 80s when I lived here, that the Croydon Centre, you know, had its difficulties, and sometimes people use the word Croydon still as a sort of, you know, it's like Croydon means, oh my goodness, it's terrible, it's a cult. And they were. I mean, you know, I was part of the madness at that time. That's a whole story in itself, although there's some very, very positive and good things happening as well. You know, a lot of people got ordained from those times. But I had a whole sort of period with Sangharakshita where I'd have arguments with him about what was going on here, which is quite interesting in itself, because you know the atmosphere here became, it became a negative group among some of us. I was definitely a part of that, a sort of power structure. And I remember I'd go to Papaloka and on retreats, and I'd go for a walk with Sangharakshita, or I'd go and see him in his study, and he'd say, I'm concerned about this in Croydon. You know, and it would be the way somebody had been treated, or the fact that we weren't going on all the weekends, or the sort of isolationism that we were sort of developing. And I'd say, no, Bhante, it's not like that. You know, you've really got to understand, you know, that, you know, we're really doing this. And no, I really think you need to look at this. And we'd go around the village in Sirlingham having these arguments, which is really interesting because, well, the fact that Sangharakshita didn't mind the fact that I argued, and, you know, he was trying to convince me to look again at what was going on. And it was quite a sort of intense period. And I'd come back, you know, from being with him and you know, have to kind of report on that. You know, that was quite difficult with the people here. On one occasion when we were having one of these sessions, Sangharakshita and I, he looked at me and he said, you're being ground between two stones. I thought, what do you mean by that? I really didn't, you know, but he was basically saying, come on, you're going to need to really look at what you're doing. You know, what's happening? You know, you're going to have to start looking deeper at these sort of circumstances. And I remember on one occasion in particular where I was defending some pretty unskillful activity here in relation to somebody who was not being treated very well. Sangharakshita reached a point where he'd obviously had enough of my of me being so obdurate, and that sometimes people say that anger can be sort of it can be sort of skillful when it sort of breaks through something, and I've never felt able to do that myself. I'm very suspicious of my own anger, but I felt it on this occasion from him. He suddenly really put the burners on, looked very directly at me and basically said, this has really got to stop. You've really got to look at what was going on. I thought, blimey. And it was very, very clean. There was no sense of being harmed or injured or wounded. It was as if somebody was saying, wake up, Padmavajra, wake up. And it was all to do with the fact that somebody was being harmed. Wasn't to do with, you know, doctrine or anything like that. It's to do with the way somebody was being treated. It was sort of fierce or love, really, I would say. So sometimes kindly speech can be like that. But the time where it was most sort of devastating was over at Aryatara. And Sangharakshita had come here and he'd given a lecture here, I think. I forget what the lecture was. Might have been Buddhism, World Peace and Nuclear War here in this very room. And I was sort of looking after him. And for some reason, there was just the two of us back at Aryatara eating together. And I started to go to India again, but I was coming back here and I was uncertain about my future. And I said to Sangharakshita, what do you think I should do? I'm wondering about my future. Should I spend more time in India or what? He said, well, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I think I'll just stay in Croydon. He said, I don't think that's a good idea. And I thought, oh, he's not usually this prescriptive. He's usually quite... he usually throws you back on yourself. And he said, young single men really need to make sure that they mature and grow up. And there is this emotional immaturity that has been noticed. My emotional immaturity. He said, it doesn't really matter what you do, but you've got to take responsibility for yourself. You can be a hermit. You can write books. You can start a centre, but you have to do something from yourself, because I tended to be somebody who would get in the slipstream of a big person. That's what I tended to do, and that's what I was doing at that time in Croydon. And it really, really struck me, this point to do with the need to mature emotionally and to take responsibility for myself and my life. It was very, very challenging. It was one of the most devastating bits of feedback I've ever had in my life, because it was so clean. There was no sense of any ill will, any impatience, any investment from his point of view about the outcome of how the criticism was received. He just said it very, very plainly, as one of the great Chan masters, it was described as being known for his flavourless speech. And this comment of Sangharakshita didn't have any flavour, if you like. I mean, it was just really, really clear. And it was something that I really took very seriously. And I spent quite a long time kind of working out. It took me some time to kind of work out the meaning of it. But it was a brilliant point, and it's something I've never forgotten. I mean, he even launched into a whole thing, and I'd been living in single sex communities for years, and he was saying, if you got married and had children, you'd have to take responsibility. You'd have to grow up, because you'd have to, take care of other people. It was really strong stuff. But it was kind. It was proper kind speech. But it was very, very clear to do with what I needed. So yes, Priya Vadita. And I have certainly been on the end of a very compassionate speech from Sangharakshita as well. I remember after things had changed in Croydon, I had to do a lot of soul searching in terms of my own participation here, my own negative participation in events. I had to do a lot of confessing and apologising to people and putting things right. It was very, very important for me to do that, and I must say people were extremely responsive in relation to that, in relation to the Sangha. And I went to see Sangharakshita to talk to him about it. I think it was on the Gukhiloka course I was on in 1990, and I said, look, I just want to apologise to you for all the trouble that I gave you during that time, all the arguments, all the defending of the position that we were in. I'm just really very, very sorry about all the trouble I gave you. And his face took on a very particular kind of expression, which is very, very hard to describe. It was quite strange, and the atmosphere in the room became quite strange. he looked very serious, and I think it was something like compassion, the expression on his face. And he just said, "You have given me no trouble at all." And it wasn't, the flavour of it wasn't, "Well, how could a little mite like you give me any trouble?" It wasn't like that. It was as if, this is finished. This is over. That person isn't there anymore. That person that you were like, it's not there. It's as if it was completely clean. So yes, these examples of Sangharakshita's loving speech. So I want to go on to Sangharakshita, the third of the Sangharavastus, and that's Artacharya, living meaningfully, living for the good. Arta is one of these words that you get in Buddhism, which is used quite a lot. It can mean the goal, it can mean nirvana, it can mean enlightenment. It can, yes, mean meaning and good and all these things. So it's a life lived full of meaning, a life lived for the good, for the goal, for the best, the highest. And the way that's explained in this Sangharavastu is that you live, the most meaningful way that you live is to communicate the Dharma as fully as you possibly can to people, not by, you know, sort of negative proselytizing or something like that, or dragging Buddhism into every conversation. But you're so in touch with the Dharma that it's naturally happening. And of course, it does also mean formal Dharma talks. It means, you know, all the different ways in which we communicate the Dharma. And it's interesting, another way it can be translated is doing good. And sometimes, you know, people, you know, you sometimes get this thing raised, don't you, that if Buddhism is, Buddhists are supposed to be compassionate and loving, why aren't they doing more for the environment or social work, or, you know, more of that obvious hands-on work to make the world a better place, which, you know, if Buddhists want to do that, that's fine. But Sangharakshita really sees that the Dharma is really needed, that is social work, that the deepest part of us is our potential for Buddhahood. He has enormous faith, is that the right word? I think faith probably is the right word, but that is the deepest place that people need to live from. And if people were living from that more, well, there would be a lot of, you know, there wouldn't be so many problems in the world, and people would come together more powerfully. And of course, he's lived a life of almost continuous Dharma teaching, constant, you know, Dharma teaching. You know, yes, formally in lectures and study seminars, there's hours and hours and hours of formal teaching. But being around him is like being with somebody where you're never away from that sort of that sense of the Dharma kind of going in. I felt that. Again, that sort of experience, it's a bit like the sort of the loving speech experience, but this was a real Dharma teaching. This was in India before I came to Croydon. So it was Sangharakshita's sort of return to India, his first visit to India after he'd come to the West and, you know, started the movement here. And I had the great good fortune of going to India when we started things, when Lokamitra started things. I was very close to Lokamitra, in the Archway Centre in North London, and I went with him when he started things. So I was there right at the beginning of our Dharma activities in India. Tremendously formative period for me. Not an easy time, but, you know, I was so glad to be there. And I saw Sangharakshita come and teach the Dharma in India. Roll out the Dharma. I'd seen him teach the Dharma in the West, really tuned into people in the West, and here he was rolling out the Dharma in India to, well, I've never been to lectures of a few thousand people, never been with a few thousand people chanting the refuges and precepts. And the atmosphere among these Dalit Buddhists, these so-called ex-untouchable Buddhists, who were, you know, just so pleased that Sangharakshita was back teaching them again. The atmosphere was extraordinary. Tremendous gratitude, tremendous atmosphere, you know, really amazing sort of atmosphere. And Sangharakshita just so tuned up to the needs of those of that particular, you know, community. I'll say more about that in the next of the Sangharavastus. And yeah, the atmosphere was amazing. And I was Sangharakshita's sort of attendant at that time, which was really lovely, you know, job. You know, I'd wash his robes and make him tea, type his letters. And the really great job that I really liked was after these big lectures, was gathering up all the garlands, because in India, you know, when a great teacher gives a talk, I mean, the introductions go on forever, and everybody wants to give a garland. So these wonderful marigold and tuberose and jasmine and rose garlands, an incredible sort of scent. So I'd have to gather all these garlands up, find his sandals, stick them on his feet, and then take him through the crowds, and, you know, off we'd go back to the place that we were staying and hang up all the garlands. And this was so exciting, so inspiring, so wonderful to be part of this whole atmosphere. And I put Sangharakshita's mosquito net up every night before he went to bed. And I was overcome with emotion and devotion and gratitude. And I turned to Sangharakshita just as I was leaving the room, and I said, Bhante, I don't know what I will do when you die. And he, quick as a flash, he turned to me and said, that's assuming that I'll die first. And he really looked, and he really meant it. I was really scared. I was out that door in a flash. And it was really, you know, it was really throwing me back, you know, on myself. He's teaching the Dharma, living meaningfully. A tremendous sort of awareness. He'd just given, you know, a talk for an hour and a half, because in India you have to give really long talks, hour and a half, 2 hours. But he's still teaching, still the teacher, still, you know, it's still the sort of the embodiment of that quality, the Vajra, in this case, the Vajra Guru, the no-nonsense guru who, you know, presents reality face-to-face to the disciple. That's the way I took it. And sort of recurring theme, I mentioned this business about responsibility under Priyavadita. I was looking through some letters recently that Sangharakshita had sent me, and I kept noticing this theme of taking responsibility. In this particular letter, he was saying, it was about a dilemma I was in, and he said, whatever decision you make, know that I have full confidence in you, that you will make the best possible decision, not just for yourself, but for everybody concerned. And I was reading these letters because I was asked to talk about what had I gained as a disciple of Sangharakshita. What had been the main sort of message? It was responsibility. Individual responsibility. That's the message again and again and yet again. You can do it. You have to do it. It's down to you. And in so many ways, that's been the strong, you know, Dharma message. But I want to, you know, come on to Samanatata, which can be translated as exemplification, practicing what you teach, embodying the Dharma. Obviously, that's very attractive. That really does create a community. Sangharakshita is quite careful in his exposition of this. It doesn't mean being perfect. You'll be all relieved to know, all the order members and team members running classes here, you don't have to exemplify perfection, few. You exemplify a life lived, you know, the effort of practicing the Dharma. That's what you exemplify to others. You share your successes, you will also share your failures with others, but you exemplify the committed life, the life committed to following the Dharma. As I said, I don't think of Sangharakshita as perfect, but for me, he really exemplifies somebody who's tried to live the path of a bodhisattva, somebody who's really lived to practice the Dharma for the benefit of others and to bring the Dharma to others in whatever way, and, you know, to many others. And so there's this other meaning of samanatata, which can mean empathy, sympathy, really treating others as you treat yourself, treating others as you treat yourself, or even better, really tuning into where people are. Of course, this is the great meaning of skillful means, that, you know, a bodhisattva is someone really who really can sense where people are, their particular circumstances, and bring the Dharma in its fullness to them. In its fullness, not just a little bit of it, but in a way that is revealing, or can reveal, the whole scope of the Dharma, but exactly, you know, where they are, to their position. And I saw this very, very vividly in India. Obviously, I saw it in the West, but in India, I saw it particularly with Sangharakshita, because, well, in a way, because I guess it was more vivid seeing him transcend, if you like, the difference of cultures. Of course, he had lived in India for many years. He'd worked with that community for many years. And I remember he started one lecture in India, great big lecture, you know, a few thousand people. And he started off with an exposition of the Yogacara system of consciousness. So you have to remember, you know, with this few thousand people, quite a few of those people probably be illiterate, quite a few of those people not very educated at all. And here he was, expounding the Yogacara system of consciousness, the Vijnanavada, the six sense consciousnesses, the defiled mind consciousness, which distinguishes between self and other, and which, you know, has these deep kleshas to do with self, and then the Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse consciousness, which, you know, stores all the traces of our skillful or unskillful action. And I thought, well, where's he going? And I'm watching the crowd, and they're all up for it. They're riveted, you know, by this discussion. So this is a very complex system, but somehow he's making it very, very direct, very vivid for people. And I remember we get to the defiled mind consciousness, the consciousness that believes in duality. Well, not just believes in it, but there's this deeply held sense of duality between grasper and grasped, self and other, subject and object, the basic impurity. And then Sangharakshita said, and this is where caste comes from. This is where the whole notion of untouchability comes from. In other words, it comes from the minds of men and women. It's there in consciousness. And, you know, in Indian talks, if people make a particularly good point, there's applause. You know, everybody loved this point. It was a beautiful sort of symmetry how he got to it, really tuning into people. So I saw this, him bringing the one of the most profound, sophisticated expositions of the Dharma, but really tuning into where people were, to their particular circumstances. No sort of sense of talking down, you know, to those people. No sort of sense of, oh, well, they just need very, just very, very elementary sort of teachings and things like that. Really tuned into them. And, you know, I saw it when he was talking to one of the Dharmacharinis, the first Indian Dharmacharini, Dharmalochana. Sangharakshita in those days still knew a bit of Hindi, and I saw him talking to her in Hindi about her meditation practice, and there was this incredible quality of attention as he was describing to her how to meditate on this particular bodhisattva and all the different processes that you need to go to. Such sensitivity, such attunement, you know, to her. It's more than empathy. It feels almost sort of psychic, almost as if he sort of knows her mind. And I had my own experience of that one day while we were in India, I was sitting with Sangharakshita and Lokamitra. The three of us were sitting there, and Lokamitra and Sangharakshita were having a conversation. They were talking about Dharma order members who were good at giving talks in the movement. And Sangharakshita said, well, we've got some quite good speakers emerging now. Spoot is very good, and Nagabodhi is very good, and you're good, Lokamitra. And I was sitting there thinking, well, what about me? And then he turned to me with this grin on his face, and of course, of the younger order members, Padmavajra is a very good speaker. And he just really weird smile, and he said, as if to say, is this what you want? And I thought, oh my God, he reads my mind. I thought about it later, and I thought, oh no, actually, he didn't really read your mind. Your thoughts were so loud. Probably anybody could have heard them. But yes, that sort of, you know, tuning in to somebody. But more sort of sensitively, I remember after one of these lectures going through the crowd. And in India, people are very, especially older people, especially women, are very, very devotional, and they express that very, very directly. So we're going through the crowd, and people are coming to touch Sangharakshita's feet. Very, very traditional way of doing it. And I thought, well, hang on a minute. He's just given a great big lecture. He's tired. We need to get him home. And I'm sort of barging people out of the way. Sangharakshita very firmly, but very gently, put his hand on my shoulder and said, no, no, you mustn't do that. This is very important for people. Because, of course, they've been used to being treated as untouchables. You don't, especially don't touch a holy man. And I felt from him a real, well, compassion, sensitivity, deep sympathy for me, because I was uneducated and uncivilized and not tuned up, but more importantly, for the people. It's not that he needed that adulation or anything like that, but there was this deep feeling for that community, for those people, for their particular plight. I remember meeting a Buddhist politician when we were there on that visit, an old disciple of Sangharakshita, and he was quite a big man in the Congress Party at the time. And he came to see us, Lokamitra and I, and he was he said we'd never met anybody like Sangharakshita when he was here. He said he came to our district, Ahmednagar, extremely poor part of Maharashtra, and he said he didn't mind what he ate, what he drank, how he travelled, walking from place to place. He said we had asked other monks to come, and they had all sorts of, they wouldn't come unless there was a car or special food, or they slept in a special bed. He said Sangharakshita didn't do anything like that. He was just with us, with the people. And he had tears. This is a hard politician rolling down his cheeks. And I thought, well, I just don't know Sangharakshita. I don't know what he did here in India. But this sort of sense of really being with the people, really bringing the Dharma to the people. And of course it goes on. He's still at it. He's still concerned about the Dharma. People go and see him. He's sitting in his chair. He's very old. He wants to know what's going on. He keeps asking, you know, questions. We were up on a retreat recently, a private preceptor's retreat. He was asking the people going to see him, well, are order members still doing their meditation on their Buddha or Bodhisattva? Are they emphasizing this teaching and that teaching? Still teaching. And of course, he doesn't see himself as indispensable. He started something. He's very, very clear about that. He started something. And, well, I feel very, you know, very, very strongly. The way I really want to honour and serve him is by continuing this tradition that he started, really developing it through practicing, particularly these Sangraha Vastus, which we can all practice as a community to attract people to the Dharma. Generosity, loving speech, living meaningfully through really communicating the Dharma vividly to people, and exemplifying and empathising in relation to others. So I better stop there. Thank you very much.